Hey, it's Justin, and I have a big announcement and personal invitation for you. This May, we're inviting a small group of people to Austin to learn how to grow their wealth tax-free and get access to some of my personal friends and experts in the industry. We did something similar last year, and the feedback was incredible, so we set aside a few tickets for non-Mastermind members to join us for this event. You'll spend some time learning from Garrett Gunderson, the brilliant and hilarious mind behind Money Unmasked and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling book, Killing Sacred Cows, and one of my favorite books, What Would the Rockefellers Do? He's going to share his insights on how to grow your assets tax-free with life insurance. And you'll also get some time with Rob Dial, the mastermind behind the Mindset Mentor podcast, who will share with you how to find fulfillment in success. Then you'll get to participate in a special investment presentation, in-depth discussions, and breakout sessions on two crucial yet often overlooked topics: personalized tax strategies and wealth building. Plus, when you register, you'll have the opportunity to attend a one-day course the day before on vetting deals. If you want to learn our process so that you can make great decisions, there's no better teacher than Hans Box. This is our most requested topic, and it'll be an exceptional course. Seats for the course and the one-day event are limited, so if you're interested, please grab your ticket today. I always say you're just one connection, one decision, and one strategy away from true freedom, and I look forward to helping you on your journey. Head over to lifestyleinvestor.com/live or click the link around this video and secure your ticket now before we sell out. Hope to see you in Austin this May. Once again, that's lifestyleinvestor.com/live. I can't wait to see you there. Now, let's get into today's episode. Welcome to the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. Imagine being able to earn passive income, build long-term wealth, while gaining total freedom from your business or job. That's what lifestyle investing is all about. I'm your host, Justin Donald, and in less than 2 years, my investments drove enough passive income for both my wife and me to quit our jobs. And now I want to show you how to do the same. I want to teach you how to create wealth without creating a job. You'll learn the exact same investment strategies I used to multiply my net worth to over 8 figures, all before the age of 40. If you want to learn all about low-risk cash flow investing, achieve financial freedom, and live the life you truly desire, this podcast is going to show you exactly how to do it. In this episode, I'm speaking with Darius Mirshazadeh. Darius is a high-growth CEO, serial entrepreneur, and culture-building mad scientist who was ranked number 9 on Glassdoor's list of top CEOs of small and medium companies in the U.S. He's led organizations that have won numerous Stevie Awards, been named number 3 place to work by San Francisco Business Times, and has landed at number 40 on the Inc. 500 list of fastest growing companies. He has been recognized in the New York Times and Inc. magazine for innovation in corporate culture, and his business insights and thought leadership have been published in Huffington Post, Entrepreneur.com, Fast Company, and Forbes. Darius is also the author of The Core Value Equation, a framework to drive results, create limitless scale, and win the war for talent. Today, Darius joins the podcast to share his unique entrepreneurial journey from building a multi-million dollar mortgage company that came crashing down to teaching entrepreneurs how to leverage core values so that they can create high growth, high impact, and highly scalable businesses. One more thing before we get to today's interview. If you haven't already, be sure to hit the subscribe button on Apple or wherever you listen so new episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. Thanks for listening. And without further delay, my conversation with Darius Mirshazadeh. All right. Well, Darius, I'm so glad that we could get together and spend some time together. We've actually been hanging a lot here recently, and really, I feel like I'm the lucky recipient of, you know, you and your incredible expertise and knowledge. So thanks for joining us.
Man, the feeling is mutual, Justin. I'm the cheerleader from behind the stands. I'm like, going on the Amazon. I'm like, man, he's got to be number one by now. Number one, you know, and I'm totally cheering on the Lifestyle Investor, the fact that you guys hit number one. I mean, you were like number one for the entire, every nonfiction book on Amazon. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I was totally blown away and totally pleased. But yeah, for MLK week, we were number one nonfiction, all books, and then number eight overall of every book, 50 million books out there. We were number eight there for a certain period of time. We fluctuated anywhere from like eight was the best to like somewhere in the top 25 each day that week. And I still think we're ranked pretty high right now.
You don't have to answer this, but are you guys getting other types of rankings outside of Amazon, like the Wall Street Journal or anything like that? Are you getting there?
We'll see. I think time will tell. I'm eagerly awaiting. I think that there is a strong likelihood of it, but I don't want to, you know, what is it? Count your chickens before they hatch. So I'm just being patient. And you know what? If it doesn't hit, that's all right. And if it does, it would be exciting. I didn't write the book for a bestseller, but if it does, I feel like it's kind of like it feels good that the hard work is recognized.
Yeah, I was talking I was on Clubhouse. I was talking to Marshall Goldsmith, who's written a ton of books. He wrote What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And he's like voted number one business coach in the world. His clients are like the CEO of Boeing, right? And he was talking about the likelihood to get a person to buy your book is like, it's like under 1%, like to do it like unprovoked, not like family and friends. It's super small, right? Let alone to be number one for nonfiction for the whole Amazon, which is insanity. And this is coming from personal experience, right? Like we both launched books. I mean, I was like, I think top 100 in business and I killed myself, right? So it's a testament to the content. Because the book game is interesting. It's the first business I've ever seen that, like, I don't care how hard you worked. It's like, it doesn't matter. Like, you could kill yourself and people are just like, don't care, you know? So I think a lot of it has to do with how does it resonate? And in my book, I think it actually resonates with a lot of people. So I'm like, typically, I mean, now my book's been out for 4 months, The Core Value Equation. And yeah, it's like top 20 in office management on a regular basis, which is awesome. It keeps getting bought. I'm actually selling more books every month. But our good friend John Ruland said, Darius, the first day is, you know, everyone gets really caught up in the first week because you're kind of taught to do that. And that ether rubs off, you know, pretty quick, right? You know, a month from now, you won't feel the same way about it, right? 2 months from now, it'll just be something you did 2 months ago. But he's like, it's a 5-year event. And I know, and he learned that from a friend of yours, who's someone I just recently met, Hal Elrod, who did Miracle Morning, right? So I got really comfortable with that, which was, this is just the beginning, you know? Like the awards are great, but like impacting lives is way more important, you know? So that's where I'm pumped, but I'm pumped for you because you deserve it, man. The resonance is there and I'm rooting for you, so.
Well, I appreciate it. And we're going to get into your book here a little bit later on today. And I'm excited about your book for many reasons and on many levels. But one of the things I want to say is, you know, it's really easy to sell yourself short. This is for anyone and everyone. Like I've sold myself short. I feel like, you know, you've sold yourself short. A lot of people I know sell themselves short on many different things. But when it comes to writing a book, that's a huge undertaking. And no matter how many people buy it, it's a great accomplishment and you're going to have impact. And so I heard a stat. So I became friends with, I don't know if you're familiar with Neil Strauss. He's an author. He's one of my favorite all-time authors. Well, he's good friends with someone I just became friends with who owns a local acai bowl and smoothie place here in town called Sun Life Organics. His name's Khalil. And he's really good friends with Neil. And he edited his book when it came out. And his book is incredible, by the way. Also, I'm in the midst of reading his. But before I even share that, one of the things that he said that Neil told him is that the average book, and this is going to blow your mind, the average book sells 200 copies. That's it. The average book. So I know you've sold way more than that.
Oh yeah, no, I sold a ton of. I've sold, I probably sold like 7,000 or 8,000 books now. You know, it's a lot of books. I did it the old-fashioned way, elbow grease. I went out and just started banging on my network's doors, and got them to buy books, which was when I said, I mean, I did that. That's pre-sold. I pre-sold a lot of those books. But to your point, it was, you got to leverage your strengths, right? I didn't have a community. I didn't have a list. I didn't have a digital network. I had literally zero of that, which is the one thing I would tell any good new author that really wants to leverage their book sale is, if you want to do the work to really maximize the impact, you got to have a community to put the work into, because without that, it is a heavier lift. You know, for me, my number one mistake was I didn't have a community beyond me. You know, 100 CEOs are my friends, and they all bought bulk. They bought a lot of books and they gave them out to their teams. But that doesn't move the needle if you want to get organic traffic. If you want to get, you know, if you want to get that word of mouth type of momentum, you got to have a community to put the book into. So for me, I'm building that right now, which is fun and cool. I don't remember who I was talking about. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be a sleeper. My book's going to be one of those where it's like, it's just the long ramp up and it's going to sell a ton of books over a long period of time. And I'm like, I'm cool with that.
Well, I have no doubt and we can get into all this now, we can get into it later, but I mean, you've built this incredible coaching practice just out of nowhere, which is so cool. And you're coaching just high level executives. You're coaching people on literally reorganizing and recreating the values of their organization and like just retooling and reframing what people do. And I know this firsthand because you're doing this with Front Row Dads. And I'm part of that organization. I'm on the board of Front Row International, Front Row Global. And so, I mean, I see this work firsthand and it's incredible what you are doing.
Thank you. So my last business, I grew from 30 to 1,000 employees in 3 years. It was a 9-figure company, and like not like a barely 9-figure, like a legit 9-figure company. And it had always been my dream to hit that $100 million number. And then I hit it and I kept like leveling up above it. And this isn't one of those like 100 million, like where people buy internet ads and it's, you know, 0.1% profit margin. It's a pass through. I have friends that own these companies where they're counting other people's revenue as theirs. This is like a real business. The business now manages $100 billion worth of mortgages. And I grew it from literally like a puny little company with my partners. I always say I'm like one of the rare CEOs that can take literally have zero people and grow it to 1,000, because it takes a different type of CEO at these different levels. And I was just like obsessed. I had obsessiveness and curiosity about being better at the different levels. And I just kept leveling up. And so now I feel like I can run a business or help someone run a business, probably up to $500 million in revenue, maybe a little more.
Yeah. I think you're underselling yourself, because you and I both know once you have the skill set, you know, at half a billion, you can do it at a greater level, right? So maybe you haven't, but I wouldn't let that stop you. You have exactly what it takes, because I've seen you in action. I know what you can do. And I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that it's just a matter of time until that is going to be your target client, billion plus.
Yeah. I think once you start playing at that level, I call it multiples of 10. It's how many multiples of 10 can I manage? Because what ends up happening is one manager can generally only manage 10 people consistently without there being breaks in the system. So 1,000 people is just 110s, right? So it's 100 groups of 10. When you start doing that, it's like, what the hell is the difference between 100 groups of 10 versus 200 versus 500 groups of 10? It's all kind of the same, right? Because the skill set you need to manage 100 groups of 10 is pretty much the same skill set you need to manage 500 groups of 10, right? That's kind of the way I look at it. And so what happens is people can't get out of their own way for the first 3 or 4 groups of 10, right? They end up, because you got to have an effective manager. In my business, I had 153 managers at one point.
That's massive, Darius.
Yeah. When you have 153 managers, you got to build systems and infrastructure. So to your point, I just say 500 million because I'm like, if someone asked me if they're running a billion, you know, could I help them? Depends. I mean, I have clients that are a couple hundred million. I look at their stuff and I'm like, man, you have a lot of work to do. Right. So I have 11 clients right now, and their average revenue, like real revenue, is $68 million. That's my average client. And I ride shotgun with these CEOs. I go in there and I'm like, I need to get you to 9 figures. And I just look at it like, I literally, Justin, I'm like, how can I, if I was CEO, what would I do right now? And I just, I forget that they're even there. Because a lot of times the CEO's like, you know, I had one guy say like, you know, said something, made a reference towards he being my boss. And I laughed. I said, I think you got this backwards, man. CEOs aren't used to that, right? And I'm like, you know, I'm your coach. Like, you're listening to me. And if you're not, it's cool. We don't have to work together because I don't care if you get to 100 million. You care if you get to 100 million, you know? And so, I mean, I've been there. I've done that. Like, for me, this is like, I do this because I'm really interested in it and it's fun. It's not because I have to do it. And that's cool. It's liberating to be in that place. And that's a big part of your book, The Whole Lifestyle Investor, is doing things you want to do it, you know, not because the other stuff's taken care of for me now. You know, I've made money. So the money part is, it's a game now for me, is like, and the winnings say that I'm creating value. So that's a big part for me, is getting in there, ripping open the hood and saying, all right, well, what's broken? All right. Who's the problem here? All right. How are we set up to scale, and then digging in deep and figuring that stuff out? So I love it. I love it. I mean, I just got off a call right now, and what ends up happening at that level, you just have a different set of problems, right? They're big boy problems. Like, hey, should I buy 10% more interest from my co-partner? And, you know, and it's, I got to go get a 8-figure loan to go do it. And should I, you know, buy this big asset, or should I acquire this company, or should I go and get venture capital, or should I do a licensing deal with a Fortune 100 company? Those are all problems I've actually dealt with. You know, like, those are all things that appeared in my entrepreneurial life. Every single thing I just said, I did. Some of it was raising 9 figures, you know, trying to raise 9 figures, and should we go public, and should we consider becoming a SPAC? You know, like, these are all these things that when you start playing at those levels, you do. And when you're playing at the 8-figure level, you're not, because you're not quite big enough yet. So for me, I like digging in and looking at that. And then what I've done now is, where you and I have really connected, is I'm like, well, I don't have to be the CEO of the company to apply these skill sets. Maybe I want to just be the investor. Maybe I want to build a fund and start buying these companies and really help them in a different way. So that's where that's my new chapter I'm playing with. Even with the coaching, as I was telling a good friend of mine, said, I'm pretty sure this is going to turn into private equity for me. Like, I really love looking at it. I don't want to operate the companies. I did that for 20 years and I love it. I learned a lot, but I think I'm at a new stage. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's great having the operating experience, because that's why you can do what you can do. So it's necessary. It's most likely mandatory. Most people really need that to be able to be in a position to coach and help. But once you've done it, you realize all the responsibility, the weight, the pressure, everything falls on you. And it really is fun when you can switch that around and you can either, you know, A, do what you and I have done a lot of, which is advising and consulting companies, you know, business owners, entrepreneurs, which I think is great. Because then you get the, like, part of what you like, which is solving problems and creating value, but you're not stuck in the day-to-day. You're purely working on the business, not in the business, which is ultimately the way that you should have been doing it originally when you were running a company. But sometimes you're too busy to even know that that is an option, or it's an afterthought, right? It's like 10 years later, you're like, that's what I should have been doing, but I didn't even think that that was something to do back then.
You know what's funny is I had such an aversion towards the actual doing of work that I was really good at pulling myself out of the business. Like, and this started literally, I mean, my first company I built was number 40 Inc. 500. And I was 28 when we were awarded that. I was 25 when I started the company.
So talk a little more about that.
Yeah. So I started off as an entrepreneur. Like, my dad was an entrepreneur. He owned gas stations and he was kind of a victim of the whole Persian Revolution. So, I was born here with my brother but my mom's American, my dad's Persian. And so I grew up around an entrepreneur. I grew up around a guy who was in the business operating gas stations. And frankly, he did not enjoy that business. Like, he was a really smart guy, and not to say gas station owners aren't smart guys, but that's a grind of a business. I worked at a gas station from the age 10 till 18. So I grew up watching someone be an entrepreneur, and it was just like, that was the norm. My dad did entrepreneurial things. He owned real estate and bought and sold gas stations. And his whole thing was, you don't make money selling gas, you make money selling gas stations. So I remember learning that lesson when I was 16. So I was lucky to have that learning at a very young age. What it ended up doing was making me not very employable, because I always just looked at things as a business owner. Like naturally I would do it because I was brought up around that environment. So when I was 20 years old was when I had my first big business failure. I had a nightclub business that I had started that failed. It was my first six-figure loss. I got killed, made some really bad strategic decisions and didn't do my homework and lost that business. Pivoted for, you know, I'm 22, 21 pivoting, right? That's kind of a funny idea, but pivoted and started a magazine and started, you know, another nightclub business and ended up in the mortgage industry as a day job because they paid commission only and I could make a lot of money.
I love it. Real quick, if you're going to lose money, lose it as early in life as you can. I mean, I love that you lost money at 22. You know, what a great time, because you can make that back. You have so much life in front of you. You have, like, it's just such an ample, like, learning ground, you know, when that's the case. This is so cool. Keep going. I love your story. And by the way, this, you know, getting into the lending space, I feel like this was maybe one of the defining moments, one of the huge moments in the trajectory of your professional life.
For sure. Yeah, for sure it was. So my brother was actually, we were in lending from high school. My brother got a job, an after school job at a mortgage brokerage, got me that job. So I worked at a mortgage company in high school, but my brother was not a very good student. He was a really good salesman though, like top 0.1%. So it was the first thing. He wasn't a very great athlete growing up, and he wasn't a good student because he was like this attention deficit disorder and just wasn't a naturally gifted athlete that when you're young, even if you're a hard worker, it's not necessarily going to overcome athletic ability when you're like 10, you know. And we grew up in suburbs of Orange County, which were super competitive for that type of stuff. So he kind of got in with the bad crowd, but he got this job at a mortgage company, always a super hard worker. And he ended up, he was like a savant. Like there was a call center, there's 20 telemarketers. Let's say you had to get an average of two interested people per day. The whole group, the whole place would get, call it 40. 20 would be him and 20 would be the other 19 people. Yeah, it was amazing. And so he stuck with that. And when I was in college, he was doing that. So when I got out, it was like, well, I could go get I have a degree in business economics and accounting from UC Santa Barbara. I'm like, well, I could get a job working at like a big five accounting firm, or I could go to sell loans. And my brother was making six figures at the age of 22. So I was like, well, this is kind of a no-brainer if you ask me. So I went and started working commission only while doing the entrepreneurial stuff. And then, you know, that kind of, as we started making a lot of money in mortgage, it was just, I just followed the money. Cause for me at that point, I was very, 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 very money motivated. Like I wanted to make a lot of money. That's all I cared about. I was tired. You know, I was 21, 22. I had never had money for 22 years. My parents did well, but that was their money. And it was made crystal clear to us that you got to go earn your own money. So I had paid my way through college for the last 2 years. I was broke. And I was like, I want to make money. So that's all I cared about. And the mortgages, from what I could see, was the path of least resistance to get there. So I did it. And then I started working. I got fired from my first job in mortgage, funny enough, because they didn't have a training program. My brother was like the top dog. They called me college boy and fired me basically because I was smart, but I just didn't know the business and they didn't really have any systems to train anyone. So I ended up leaving that, got into stock trading, got back into mortgage because it was 9/11 and it was not a great environment to be a stock trader in. And started working at a small mortgage company in San Rafael, California, Marin, California. And I quickly grew that thing from a one-person shop to a 10-person shop, and I was doing everything. I was basically building someone else's company for them. And at one point, I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, I don't get paid anything to build this guy's company for him. He's a nice guy, but he's not really paying me anything. And I'm literally I'm building someone else's company, and I'm being paid commission only. And I said, well, I don't need to do this. I'll just do this for myself. So at 25, I left. I started my own shop, me and an assistant. But like I said earlier, I was always like, I don't want to do actual work. I just want to build an awesome company. And I didn't even know what that meant then. I just knew it meant like, I'm like Richard Branson and Steve Jobs. And I'm thinking of these, like, I literally have these huge aspirations. Now I'll say this, and you'll appreciate this. When I had my first failure at 22 with the nightclub business, well, before I got it back in the mortgage, when I failed, I got fired from my job in that business. I lost a six-figure business. I lost six figures in this business. It wasn't like I had, like, literally I lost $100,000 and I tapped out. That happened the same week. And so I was like super depressed and I locked myself in my bedroom and I read every single Robert Kiyosaki book I could get my hands on. Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Cashflow Quadrant. I mean, E-Myth. I started just going, any book I could get my hands on to read, I read for the next 4 months.
That's awesome.
That was my cure for my entrepreneurial blues.
Well, think about it this way. Most people, when they get dealt the hand that you got dealt, they fold. And you doubled down and said, no, I'm just going to read and I'm going to become smarter and I'm going to become better and I'm going to learn from these mistakes. But I'm most certainly not giving up because I have huge aspirations. And I love that. And we share that. You know, you and I dug into all the, you know, we've talked about this at length, all the Robert Kiyosaki books. Those are huge for me too. I mean, I wouldn't be who I am today without those books and without his influence.
Yeah, Cashflow Quadrant totally changed my life. What was funny is I didn't start applying it probably till much, much, much later. So you were smart and got applied it much earlier than I did. I really am just now starting to apply the investor mentality. What I did, and part of it was I got on this really crazy entrepreneurial ride. So I started my company after I left. It was All Bay Mortgage was the name of the company I'd built and then left. I started my own business, Twin Capital Mortgage. But it was just me and an assistant. And I said, and I made a bet with my brother. So my brother's down in Southern California. Mind you, at this point, we're 25. He's making $30,000 a month, like killing it. And I was probably making $15,000 a month, but and to me, which was a lot of money then, because I was, you know, like that's $180,000 a year. And I said, hey, why don't you come up to San Francisco and be my business partner? And he's like, well, why would I do that? I'm making more money than you are. And I said, well, I got a bet. And this is funny. He was engaged to be married at the time, and I didn't like his fiance.
Uh-oh.
So I said, hey, I got an idea. This is July-ish of 2003. I said, the month I make more money than you do, you have to break up with your fiance, and you have to move to San Francisco and be my business partner. And so, yeah.
All order. And he took it. He took the bet.
Yeah, because he was like on the ropes with his fiance. Yeah. It was going in the wrong direction. But he was looking for an out, I think, and I gave him one. So fast forward, I opened the business July 5th, something like that, 2003. July, August, September, the business makes $100,000 of revenue. Like I came out swinging. Yeah. Yeah. Like
that feels so good after working so hard. And then all of a sudden you see the fruits of your labor.
So, yeah. So within a week he quit his job and moved to San Francisco and became my business partner. And that day was the day I started working on the business and I wasn't working in the business anymore that day. Like literally I was like, all right, I don't want to be the salesperson. My brother's a savant for sales. I'm just going to start building the company. And so a lot of entrepreneurs, like you were saying, they work in the business. And I was really quick to work. I'm a strategic influencer. So for me, it's strategies like I love being in the strategy brain. I love being in the influence brain. The doing, the execution works. It's not, I just don't like it. It's not, I feel it makes me tired. The other stuff gives me energy. And so I started working on building the business. And I will tell you, that business grew like crazy. It grew from 320,000 and for a half a year in 2003 to 2006, we did 8.4 million.
Wow. That is incredible growth.
Yeah. And that was, I had no idea what I was doing. Literally like trial by fire. It was, and it grew to about 150 employees. And most of my employees were older than me. You know, I was just this like young kid who was just getting after it. Now the mistake I made, which was a great lesson, and it was a painful lesson, was the business was a subprime mortgage lender. And this is where, and listen, I was in company of a lot of great people like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. And, you know, there was a lot of smart people in the room that were in the same bed I was in, but it gave me some perspective around trusting my instincts when things don't feel right. And so when I started looking at the type of product we were selling, and I remember asking my head of capital markets, and we went from being a broker to turning into a bank, mortgage bank, but we were a small retail shop. I remember asking, I said, what would happen if stated income loans would go away? And by, mind you, 2/3 of my business were stated income loans.
And real quick, I need to interject real quick, because I want you to elaborate on subprime mortgages, because I would imagine not all of our listeners are fully aware of what that is. And then stated income, this is the craziest thing in the world. And I know this because I had a stated income loan back in 2005, where basically I got to say how much I made and I didn't have to prove anything. Yeah, that was it. Wrote it down on a piece of paper, got a mortgage. It was one of it was so fast. And by the way, I was honest. I wrote down what I made, but I didn't have, you know, had started my own business. And so I didn't have any, there was nothing to prove what I was making. Like I had just started.
No documentation. Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah. So right now, if you look at the mortgage market and, you know, I have 20 years of domain expertise in mortgage. So And I've done everything from telemarket, as I mentioned, all the way to managing what's the business I left and just exited, now manages $100 billion worth of mortgage assets. So like literally, I know I'm probably one of the, there's probably three people on earth that have this experience and I'm one of them. The other two is my brother and my other, there's four, my brother and my other two business partners. Very few people have actually done all those things, because it's very rare that someone's starting as a telemarketer and working their way all the way to managing assets. But now, if you look at mortgage market, probably 80% of the market is going to be dominated by the agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae. 20% is going to be 10 to 15, 20% is going to be private securitization. That's going to be basically the private secondary market. Wall Street's buying those loans directly. It's done through the bond market. If you go back to 2003, 4, 5, 6, that marketplace grew from about 15% market share to, I want to say, 45 or 50% market share. It was a really high market share. And the agencies had to open their credit box. What that meant was I could go and I say, hey, Justin, you want to create a mortgage? We could create our own rules for the mortgage. There's not these federal agencies that have their really strict rules around, you know, debt to income ratio or loan to value, or these mortgage terminologies. Like you have to have, so right now, if you want to do a Fannie or Freddie loan, you can only take on debt that equals about 40 to 43% of your total gross income. That includes taxes, insurance. That also includes like your other debts, credit card debt, minimum payments, auto loans, stuff like that, taxes, interest, and the mortgage. That could be no more than, I call it, 43% of your income. For Ginnie Mae, they'll go up to 56% of your income. That's going to be FHA, VA, and USDA. These are all government sponsored. The United States government backs this, and it's probably 90% of the market now. Rewind all the way to 2006 when I said the thing I just said out loud. It was 50 to 60% of the market. Oh, and the other 40% was competing against that. So they were having, they had these programs where they wouldn't verify income and stuff like Fannie Mae had a program where they didn't verify your income. So there were these loans that were like, essentially they opened the door for what was called liar loans, liar, L-I-A-R. And so on private securitization, you could do what was called a ninja loan. No income, no job, no assets. Like literally, I could just like write on a piece of paper anything I wanted. And you're supposed to like be honest, but no one verified it. So that opened up Pandora's box. There was a lot of, listen, if you ever want to see craziness, go on Wall Street and see CMOs, CLOs, CDOs. They create these crazy, like basically virtual instruments, derivatives to then go resell, so that you can basically place that same one loan became 50 loans and you get 50 bets on the same loan. And then they cut it into tranches. I mean, I'm getting really technical, where first loss, second loss, and they kind of assign credit risk to these different tranches in the bond. And so what ended up happening, you can watch The Big Short by Michael Lewis. That movie kind of gives you a more interesting, entertaining version of what I'm talking about right now. I was some little puny little mortgage broker, barely banker, who was doing $30 million a month of this business. And I got crushed. Literally, my $8.4 million a year business, was had a run rate of $10 million at that point, went from $1 million a month of revenue to about $150,000 of revenue literally overnight.
Wow. That is intense.
Like overnight, Justin, as in it may have gone from 1 million to like 80,000, and I figured a way to get it back to 150.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what most people don't realize when they're building their businesses is that your expenses accrue in arrears. I learned that the hard way, which means when I'm building my pipeline, my expenses that hit in September actually happened in July. So that's fine and dandy unless your revenue doesn't show up in September the way it's supposed to. You know, a lot of people are experiencing this with COVID right now. So when your revenue drops from 1 million to 80,000, but you have $1 million of expenses, which by the way, at that point I started like my margins were getting eroded. So I was at like, I started breaking even for the first time ever. Like literally I probably had about $2 million retained earnings in the company that I'd saved up over years. It went to 200,000 in 60 days.
Oh my goodness sakes. That had to be the most nerve-wracking thing.
It was a life-changing experience. What got worse though from it was actually not going bankrupt. Going bankrupt would have been God being nice to me, but instead God let me live. And then I stayed in that puny, they call it walking dead company. I was a walking dead company for all of 07, all of 08, all of 09. And then finally we got pummeled so badly with lawsuits from everything from our landlord to borrowers that we ended up shutting the company down in the beginning of 2010. Then at that point, I was still dealing with legacy issues, but all of 11 and 12, actually all of 10 and 11 were me trying to figure out my next deal. And I ended up getting into a successful joint venture by 12, 11 that profited in 12. But I had 5 years where I showed up to work and I cut checks to go to work. It cost me $2 million to go to work between 2007 and 2011.
It cost you money. Most people show up, they get a paycheck. You showed up with a paycheck to pay.
Yep. I didn't take a paycheck for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. It left some pretty deep scars and it was probably one of the reasons why I didn't start investing. Because when I started making money again, I just hoarded cash. I was like, I'm going to stockpile cash. Like I was like a depression person with money under my mattress.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah. So now I say it out loud. That's the reason I never really invested very much. I was like, I need cash in case I ever have my business melts down again. So, but what ended up happening was 13, by 12, I had a successful exit of a joint venture I did with a company that ended up selling to a publicly traded company. I parlayed that into my next business, which was The Money Source. And I learned a lot about how do you scale a business. I mean, I scaled up and then scaled down. And then my next one, I scaled up. But at TMS, we scaled from 30 to 1,000 employees in 3 years. And that was a new experience for me. But I had learned so much by just being down in the dumps for such a long period of time. I mean, what I did is I used that experience. It was a painful experience. 5 years, a long time. Like 5 years, a lot can happen or not happen. And for me, it was just getting the crap beat out of me for 5 years straight.
Yeah, I can't believe you weathered that. 5 years. You have to be like the 0.0001%. You know, it's probably even more lopsided. I mean, that is unbelievable that you could weather it for 5 years, basically paying to have a job that I know you worked a lot of hours in. So it's not like you just showed up and clocked in and clocked out and had like a 40-hour a week job. I know it was way crazier than that.
No, I was flying all over the country trying to build a business and it wasn't working. People often say like, well, I always hear people go, I wouldn't do it any different. And when people ask me, I'm like, I would never do that to myself again, ever. I don't care what I learned from it. There's better ways of learning. And that experience was a really emotional and very traumatizing experience. And it took me a long time to get over it. When you do a business like that, I learned a lot about that, which was you really have to be cognizant of the value you're creating in the world. And what I learned, and I was just young and naive. I wasn't trying to do bad loans. And the subprime lending was like I said, I was in good company.
It was normal. That was normal. It's not like people, like you could look at it today and there's, you know, there's a negative connotation and there's history. You know, there wasn't history then. This is what everyone did.
Yeah, it was unprecedented. And I mean, you know it is because almost every major bank in the United States went down. So why is that? Because they were all in on it. Everyone, if you wanted to be in real estate or real estate finance, you were a part of that machine at that time. And anyone that says different is lying. So I again was young, naive. I wasn't too focused on the product. I was like, oh yeah, this is just normal, right? And it totally was.
Well, and why do you even question it anyway? You have no reason to question it, right? That's like, I mean, there's so many examples of that we could use on this where there's no reason that you're going to buck the system because you have no idea that there's anything wrong with the system. Not yet.
Yeah. It was just one of those things where it was ignorance was bliss. Right. And so, but I got really hardcore about core values coming out of that because I felt like I got punished for doing the opposite. You know, I was selling a product that had issues and I didn't have a mindfulness around stakeholder value. I didn't have a mindfulness around creating value in the world. I felt like we were creating value in the world, but I was naive and I was young. And what came out of that was you really do need to like be aware of stakeholders. You do really need to be aware of what value you're putting into the world. And if something doesn't feel right, then don't just do it. And I was already stuck in the machine. I had a $10 million business. And what was I going to do? Oh, let's just shut it down. I don't like the products we're selling. Like by the time I recognized it, it was too late. And it was, and I paid the price hard. I got sued by borrowers. Like corporate veil doesn't mean anything. You know, I got personally sued. I shut the company down in 2010. I was being personally sued till 2013. Every single person who took a loan they didn't like named me in a lawsuit. And there was a lot of, you know, and I didn't have anything, you know, there wasn't anything to go after, but you know, there's a lot of attorneys don't care. They'll see what they can get. And so it really turned me off. And I said, I'll never put myself in that position again. And so I ended up getting really interested in, well, how do you build scale and how do you build a core value driven organization? Because I saw that business there was issues around the values in the business. Not like lots of businesses have values issues, not necessarily they're bad values, but there was a misalignment around values. We weren't all doing the same thing the same way, coming from the same place values wise. And so for me, I got really obsessed with core values right around this time this thing happened. And I think it really stung me hard because I was dealing with the repercussions of being in the wrong business and making some choices that around product, again, following the herd mentality and not saying, well, okay, well, maybe I should question whether we're proving income or not, right? I didn't even question it, nor did many people, but I paid the price for it in a pretty dear way. And, you know, going to work for 5 years, half a decade, day in and day out, and not reaping the rewards or the benefits and being punished by lawsuits and, you know, just a bunch of problems, that leaves an indelible mark on you where you change as a human being, you know, and I changed. I said, I'll never, ever have integrity be an issue in my business again. I'll never, ever, ever question a product we're selling. You know, I'll never have someone question it 5 years later. Because by the way, no one questions it when you're doing it. They question it in retrospect. And then you're like, well, what do you mean? That was fine when we did it. And they're like, that's bad now.
Yeah. As if people knew the whole time. Yeah. Well, and what's great though is you were able to parlay all this horrible experience. And by the way, we can call it horrible, but at the same time, we can also call it amazing because it allowed you to pivot, it allowed you to shift, it allowed you to create and scale a company that was based on core values. It allowed you to have a massive exit, you know, which is exciting. In fact, this is a great segue into the next topic. I won't give away numbers, but you know, you and I, we talk a ton about investing now. We're part of the same investing group, which is really fun. And, you know, so I know some of these details. I know you had a killer exit. I know you don't have to work. I know that you have like a killer lifestyle and you could have an even better one if you wanted without doing any work. So, you know, you helped build and scale this company, you exited, you are set now for life, but now instead of just, you know, kicking your feet up and going to the tropics and doing, you know, pina coladas every day, you're not doing that. You decided, hey, why don't I write a book on all these things that I've done and let me help entrepreneurs do great things that I have learned. They can learn vicariously through all my mistakes. And I'd love to know why you decided to do that when you could take the easy road.
Well, so I started writing the book actually while I was still, before I even thought of exiting. And then when I exited, that was where I kind of leaned into, because it was something that was important for me. And it was all around how I leveraged this tool of core values to create high growth scale, right? I call it invisible scale in my book. And it's my go-to tool. It's like, if I'm a carpenter, that's my hammer. Because I believe core values are the language of accountability. And for me, how do you build the most high level accountability is by creating high utility core values that can be viral in the organization. And then it becomes a tool for strategy and execution. And for me, I'm almost like, I have a very like almost engineering mindset around it. How do I take this thing and then weave it around everything we do to create more productivity, more engagement, more profit, more impact, a better place to work. And those all become this like flywheel that creates more value and gets faster. And so when I exited, I got asked by someone if they'd help a friend of theirs, you know, scale their business. And I said, I'm not interested in that. I told myself I was going to take all of 2020 off, and then COVID hit and I got focused on the book. And then when the book was launched, I got asked to do this project, and I just said, I'm taking the rest of the year off, man. Like I wasn't even planning on working at all this year. I was supposed to be in Spain. I was going to take my family and move to Spain for a year.
I remember you telling me that. Yeah.
Yeah. That was what was supposed to happen. I should be in Spain literally right now. But with COVID that got derailed and that's not happening anymore.
I think your clients are really fired up that didn't happen because you've got some raving fans.
That's true. It's true. I think they're very stoked I'm not drinking sangria right now. I got in there. I started working with these guys. It's an 8-figure company, and they're just really trying to scale. Their goal is to, you know, basically 10x their business in the next 3 years, which totally doable for them. But it was getting my hands dirty, and it was coming in from a different perspective. And I started with them in October, but I said, hey, September, we'll just like, send me a bunch of stuff. I want to start digging in. And having this perspective that I talked about before, which is, if I was CEO, I go in, I'm like, if I was a CEO, what would I do? I don't care what they say. I'm like, I need information from you. But I've got blinders on, and I'm like, and then I come up with the plan and we start working on it.
And you have no bias either. That's what's nice. You can walk in and it's not like you're saying, well, we've always done it this way, so let's just keep doing it this way. In fact, we should change something else. You actually come in and you say, well, you know, let me just look at everything. Every option's on the table. It's a total clean slate, you know?
Well, yeah. And there's all these best practices I learned over the years that it doesn't matter what kind of business you are. So I have a client. One of my clients is literally a cannabis company in California. Another one is a BPO in India. Another one is a poultry company in Canada. And with them, it's more of a specialized project, but a lot of them are in the mortgage space because that's where I came from, but they're all over the place. And one of them is a marketing education company in Florida. So I don't care. Every company has the same issues: strategy, people, process, cash, accountability. It's all the same.
Yep.
And most businesses know their business. They know their business. That I'm not going to tell them how to run their business better from the perspective of domain expertise. How I'm going to tell them, I'm going to look at it and say, are you set up to scale quickly, efficiently, and profitably, regardless of the product? Product doesn't matter. Product is a widget. Widget's a widget. I could care less about widgets. That's what got me into trouble with subprime, because I just saw it as a widget, right? I didn't really dig into like what the product was. But when mortgage, I used to tell my staff, I'm like, I don't care about the product. I'm happy we put people in homes, but it's just a widget. What I care about is building a high growth, high impact, highly scalable business. And I was the expert on scale. So when I go into my clients, I just say, if I was CEO, how would I scale this business? And it's always the same. All right, let's look. Do you have this? Nope. Do you have this? Yep. Do you have that? Nope. Do you have this? Yep. And I have a 50 question checklist. I go through it, and I think it's out of a score of 100. I think my highest client score is 50 at this point out of 100. The lowest is 19. And I'm like, all right, I'll get you to 90. It'll take me time. And there are all these best practices for running a company. It has nothing to do with the product or the industry. That's all. It doesn't matter. It's human beings. You want people to show up, do their job properly, care about the business, watch dollars and cents, and execute on the strategy and make sure there is a strategy. It's the same.
Well, I can tell you. So here's the deal. I've got your book. In fact, let me reach behind me. I have your book on my bookshelf. And you know I'm an avid reader. I read a ton of books. In fact, it's really weird when you write a book because you end up reading less books than what you used to. So, you know, this last season of writing was a lower consumption year of books. And this year, you know, with the book launch and everything this month, I've only read 3 books, which is very small for me. And so I'm only part of the way through your book. I have not finished your book, but it is great. It is riveting. It is interesting. And I'm really excited for this to be, you know, I don't know if I'm going to have it done by this month. This will probably, you know, get done first or second week in February, but I'm just thrilled with what you've been able to create. And then that you can put that into practice with, you know, people that I know. I mean, I know the people that are utilizing what you're doing.
Yeah, it's a new technology. My book is the, no one, everyone misunderstands values. And I'm like, it unlocks maximum value in your business if you can operationalize values in a way that are sticky and viral and authentic to the soul of the company. And so Core Value Equation does that. And when I look at any business, like if you really want to level up, like you got to do it. So that's, I appreciate all your kind words and having me here today. And yeah, man, I'm glad that we've met over books.
Yeah, no kidding. This is awesome. And it's so funny because I originally thought on our, you know, episode today, we get into all types of investing because you and I have dissected some deals. We've gone back and forth on some stuff. I've liked some stuff you haven't. You've liked some stuff I haven't. We've liked plenty of stuff together, but it's always fun. I like having smart people that think differently that can say, hey, did you ever consider this? It just makes all of us smarter and better investors. And so I'm so appreciative to have you in my life and in my world and someone that I can, you know, do life with, right? Families and you know, us personally, but then also be able to do investments together. And I think that that's so cool. It's so unique.
Yeah, yeah, I know we're supposed to talk about investing and we talked about my first business that blew up. But yeah,
it's great though. It worked out perfect because this is what set the stage. And now you're at a great point where you are investing. And you know, you said before you didn't have the ability to do it then. You had there was so much going on that you were just pumping everything into your business. And by the way, if your business goes really well, then that's a great strategy. Most of the time, businesses don't go really well, right? Less than 10% of the time a business makes it, you know, beyond what, 5 or 10 years. So most of the time, people that invest all the profits back into their business, it doesn't go well. So where can our listeners find you? Because I have enjoyed having you on, and I know people have loved listening to what you've been saying.
Yeah, you know, therealdarius.com is my kind of my hub, and you could go on there and connect with me on all the social networks, social media stuff. So yeah, I'm at therealdarius.com, books on Amazon and where all major books are sold. And yeah, those are the places to find me and see what I'm up to. I'm doing The Greatness Machine, which you've been a part of, and which is my show, and we're interviewing some cool people like Justin. But yeah, those The Real Darius is where everything happens. So go there, check it out, sign up for my mail list, and I promise not to spam. I only get send value. That's what I'm all about.
I love it. Well, you've added tremendous value here today. Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for your friendship. And to all of our listeners, I encourage you to take one step towards financial freedom. Take action in some way, shape, or form to live life intentionally by design, not by default. Thanks for listening to the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe so future episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. You can also leave an honest rating and review over on iTunes. Not only do I read every single one, but it also helps me understand what content matters the most to our audience. And if you can think of one or two people who could benefit from this episode, would you share it with them right now? Who knows? Maybe they'll buy you something nice when they make their first million. If you would like access to today's show notes, including links to all the resources mentioned, visit www.justindonald.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week for another episode of The Lifestyle Investor.